Okay, good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second argument on our calendar this morning, file number A201045, in the matter of the welfare of the children of CK and JDK. And we have both counsel with us this morning. Just a few words before we get started with your arguments. Because we are appearing via the Zoom platform this morning, it is possible that we will encounter some technical difficulties. If that should occur, we will simply pause and wait until everyone's technology is functioning before we resume the arguments. Of course, we'll stop the timer as well in an unlikely event that that should happen. Additionally, I would just like to let everyone know that we are recording this argument. I'd ask that any spectators not record the argument on their end, therefore. We have a timer that is visible on the screen this morning. And appellant will get 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have another 5 minutes to respond. Are both attorneys ready to go? You can nod your heads. Yes. Okay. I see that you're both ready to go. We will begin with counsel for the appellant. And please do identify yourself before you begin your argument, Mr. Steck.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jason Steck. I'm the attorney for appellant JDK, who's the father in this child protection proceeding. I'd like to begin by invoking the well-worn analogy of the three-legged stool. In a child protection case, there are three components for termination of parental rights: statutory basis, reasonable efforts, and best interest. And it's important that these all three be present before the termination of parental rights is granted. A strong showing on one basis, on one leg of the stool, such as the statutory basis, does not excuse the absence of another. Unfortunately, that seems to be the argument that ACSS is making in this case, that the statutory basis is so strong that the court should ignore the deficiencies in the reasonable efforts that ACSS provided. When we define reasonable efforts, the court has always quoted the same line that reasonable efforts are real, genuine assistance. I searched in Westlaw and that said that I found 110 times that that line's been quoted, but not a single time that it's been broken down and really looked at for what that means. And I propose that what that means is two things. If we break it down, first of all, real assistance. And second, genuine assistance. The first of these goes to the substance of the assistance.
Mr. Steck, I agree with you. I think that's a good point. But I guess the problem I have is on the reasonable efforts. When the department arranged for corrective eye surgery, your client, quote, forgot about the surgery and did not attend. He did not attend. He was not there when the department was A, providing, arranging for the eye surgery and the eye therapy. And then it was your client who lost the cab fare funding because he wasn't there. How do you respond to the argument that I'm sure the state or the department's gonna be making is it wasn't that the reasonable efforts weren't provided, it was that your client did not avail himself of the reasonable efforts that were provided.
I'd first note that primarily whatever failings my clients may or may not have had goes to the statutory basis, not the reasonable efforts. And secondly, the fact that the department offered some efforts in some areas does not excuse its deficiencies in other areas. So the fact that one effort or two efforts were provided doesn't mean that everything was fine. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. because the real point.
Fair enough. What did they not do that you think should have been done?
I think what the department did fundamentally here is manufacture an issue about drug use and then subordinate everything else, specifically the problems that initially caused the case to be opened, to that.
So, well, Mr. Steck, I realize that you're focusing on the drug issue in your brief, but isn't that a relevant issue? And isn't that more or less the underlying cause of the lot? It appears that it may be at a minimum a relevant factor for the county to consider as to whether or not he's actually doing what he needs to do. And second, with respect to, like, for instance, Judge Conley referred to the eye surgery issue. Isn't it true that the county is the one that had arranged, it helped arrange with the school for that eye therapy and for that eye surgery? So isn't that part of, isn't that relevant for the reasonable efforts that the county made?
Certainly, I would agree that the providing for the eye surgery was a necessary effort and that the county did try to provide that. But again, that doesn't mean that that's everything. And with regard to the drug issue.
Right, but that's just one example. I think the record is replete with a number of different examples of efforts that the county made to try to reach out to the first issue that you raised with respect to the case plan, try to work with him, try to help him understand what it is, try to talk to him. But he was a no-show for a lot of the meetings. He was a no-show for court appearances. Even for the trial, it was not clear whether or not he was actually in the right frame of mind, shall we say, at the court hearings. So it seems like the record is fairly replete with a lot of the efforts that the county made.
But what I think is important here, Your Honor, is that we need to look at how this process emerged. And that's really getting to my second point. But I'd just like to briefly mention why I think the drug issue is a manufactured issue. Okay. For example, in a criminal case, when we say, when we're evaluating the validity of a search warrant, we don't say that just because they found something that therefore a search warrant is okay. In this case, there was no indication at the beginning. There's no mention in the CHIPS petition, no indication at all that there were drugs involved with the problems presented. The problems presented were lack of adequate housing and medical and educational neglect. But instead of focusing on those issues, the housing and the neglect issues, the county, right from the EPC hearing on, fixates entirely on the drug issue and says, we want to go searching to see if there's an issue here, based on nothing other than we want to check. It's a fishing expedition. And then, having found an issue, they subordinate everything else to that. They withhold visitation as a punishment for noncompliance.
How is that a punishment? Isn't that trying to protect the children? And let me just turn your attention to something that appellant himself had said. He had acknowledged that using methamphetamine, the majority of the time, 28 out of 30 days, would have a significant impact on his life and his ability to parent his children. Do we need to look much further than his own acknowledgement of the impact of using methamphetamine, which he has used since his teenage years, could potentially have on his ability to parent?
With regard to the statutory basis, of course the court could look to that. But when it comes to reasonable efforts, when it comes to the point that the county is taking away visitation because they say you're not complying with the way, and I'd like to answer the court's question about isn't that a safety issue? No, it's not. There's no indication that there was a safety issue with regard to any drug use. The county made no argument and the court made no findings that there was drug use impacting the children specifically during visitation. It was simply a quid pro quo. You haven't cooperated with UAs, therefore we're taking away visitation. That's punitive. That's not rehabilitative and it's not a safety issue.
So leaving children alone is not a safety issue for the children?
Of course it is, but that's not been connected to drug use. That's a neglect issue. That's a parenting skills issue. But it's important to look and see. When addressing the parenting skills issue, the county ended parenting skills training until sobriety was demonstrated.
So his own acknowledgement that using methamphetamine would have a significant impact on his ability to parent his children is not enough right there.
Again, that would be making the statutory basis a trump card, which would then excuse the county from its reasonable efforts.
I'm just responding to your statement that there's no link between his drug use and his ability to parent, and it seems like his own words provide that link.
I was saying there was no link between his purported drug use and his visitation. There was no link that there was a safety issue with regard to visitation that necessitated ending visitation until he proved sobriety.
And just, you said purported. Is there any dispute that he used drugs?
I'm not disputing that. His own admission was a trial. But I'd also like to focus on...
Mr. Steck, following up on Judge Reyes's question, so you're saying, as I understand it, they wouldn't give him services until he got sober, and therefore that was a trap, because as long as he wasn't sober, everything else was going to flow from that. I mean, is that sort of your argument?
My argument, Your Honor, is that reasonable efforts means that we don't condition necessary services on compliance with other services.
Well, look, I mean, as a matter of common sense, someone who obviously drug addiction is a very serious thing. It's a disease, you know, one can't help oneself. But I mean, do you seriously think they were going to have him come to parenting classes while he was high? He's going to get something out of that? I mean, I understand the argument, but at the end of the day, you know, you have to, you know, in order to learn all the things you have to do, like show up for your kids' school conferences, make sure they get on the cab to go to school, make sure, they get the eye surgery, as Judge Reyes was referring to. I mean, none of that's going to happen if you are constantly high. I mean, would you agree with me?
Yes, Your Honor. And there was no finding, though, that he was high at the visitation. It was simply, you're not complying with UAs, therefore we're going to take visitation away.
Well, I mean, I thought there was a finding that his specific lack of sobriety was the express reason that two of the supervisors gave for discontinuing his scheduled visits. Are you saying he was sober on all occasions that he was visiting the kids?
I'm saying what they were basing their conclusion of lack of sobriety on was lack of his compliance with UAs. It was not a finding, you are high right now. It's you haven't proven you're not high right now because you haven't been taking UAs. The burden was on him to prove it, and until he proved it, they were going to withhold visitation. Well,
did the case plan specify that in the criminal sector, you know, the probation reports and the agreements always say, you know, an absent UA will be deemed a failure. Did the case plan indicate that an absent UA would be deemed an indication of drug use? Does the record indicate that?
I don't recall what the case plan said, but I do know that he was told that on the record by the judge. But I would like to-
That's good enough for me.
With the time I've got remaining, I would like to point out that the assistance has to be genuine as well. And what genuineness of assistance applies to is not the substance, but the attitude, the tone. This is supposed to be, if possible, a collaborative process. That's why the statute requires two things from the very beginning from the agency. It requires first that the case plan be developed jointly, and second, that it be signed by the parent. And the case law from ARB holds that it is absolutely required. These are requirements. There's not an excuse of, well, he's so bad that we don't have to do this. But that's exactly what the county is arguing here. The county argues, without any evidence in the record whatsoever, that JDK refused to sign the case plan. I've done a complete search through the transcript, and the word refuse does not appear in relation to either meeting with the with regard to the case plan or with regard to the signature. What it appears happened is this: the social worker wrote the case plan and then met with JDK to tell him what was in it. That's not jointly developing it. That's saying, here's what you have to do. And that's important, because the point of this is that it is supposed to, if possible, be a collaborative process. Now, if the parent refuses to cooperate, then the county can go to the court for a finding and say, he's refused to meet with us. That's what happened in the case that the county cites, CF. He refused to cooperate with us. He refused to cite the case, sign the case plan, so we'd like you to order it anyway. But there's no such finding here.
There's but no isn't it true that the appellant verbally agreed to the case plan on April 25th of 2020?
He verbally told in court that it was being ordered. That's not the same as signing it, and it's not same as joint participation in the development of it. Those are
so he, but he was present in the courtroom on April 25th of 2019. He was present there. He was represented by counsel. Are you saying he did not verbally agree to the case plan on that hearing date?
I'm not challenging what the record shows with regard to that, but I'm saying that it does not replace the requirement that it be jointly developed, and it does not replace the requirement that it be signed.
But wouldn't that be the time for him to object? If there is anything in the case plan that he did not agree with, that certainly would have been the time for him to object. Neither he objected nor his attorney that had been represented him, had been representing him in the court, objected to any part of the case plan at all, correct?
Your Honor, he was being told that it was being ordered. He wasn't being given an opportunity to object.
And his attorney was there present with him. His attorney never objected to any part of it. This isn't somebody who was self-represented who may not quite understand what is going on in the courtroom. This is a person who's represented by counsel, correct?
Correct. There's no indication that he objected, but there's also no indication that the statute requires an objection to require compliance.
Okay, and Mr. Steck, your time is up. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal after we hear from respondent. Next, we will hear from respondent, and I would just ask you to please identify yourself before you begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May you please the court. And this is Catherine Tim. I am an attorney with the Anoka County Attorney's Office, representing Anoka County Social Services. I'd like to address two points that Mr. Steck raised. And the first is that the county took away visitation. And that's actually incorrect. There were supervisors who at various points said that they wouldn't supervise visitation with JDK any longer due to inappropriate behaviors that they observed. However, there were continued efforts by the social worker to find other supervisors and to continue to schedule visitation. In fact, the father in this case, JDK, missed approximately half of the visits continuously throughout the case, starting in March of 2019 through the onset of trial in March of 2020, and then during the COVID time, ultimately up until the case was finally concluded in June of 2020. During that whole time, there were visits that were offered. Some of those were supervised visits. Some were in the form of skills work with Sue Haugen. Some were once the pandemic began, some of those were video type visitation, much like this hearing. But there was not a time where the county said, oh no, you can't visit. We won't let you. We didn't do that. And I think it's really an important point, particularly when the allegation is that because of his drug use, we were holding this out as a carrot. We were not doing that. We were continuing to work with JDK to assist him with housing, to assist him with finding insurance, to assist him with visitation, to assist him to get into treatment, to address his issues so that he could be a competent parent. The second issue goes to the end regarding the refusal of JDK to sign the case plan. And there is some testimony where this was addressed, and it's kind of fuzzy, and I will agree that it is kind of fuzzy on the transcript record. However, if you look at the exhibits that were set forth in the trial, you will find that there was, I believe it's, it's the court reports from that were submitted relating to the April 25th hearing and the one right after that, the June of 2019 hearing. The court reports by the social worker indicate her history of meeting with JDK to attempt to develop a case plan, and also indicate that he refused to sign it. And those court reports were adopted by the court at the time of those initial hearings, back in April of 2019, June of 2019, and then were also accepted into evidence as part of the exhibits for the termination trial and comprise part of the record. So I would say that there is substantial evidence that was accepted by the court that was addressing his refusal to sign.
Sam, I have a question along those lines because when I look at the statute and in particular the one governing case plans, Minnesota Statute 260C.212 subdivision 1B, it says as appropriate, the plan shall be submitted to the court for approval and signed by the parent. And it needs to be explained to all the parties, and particularly the parents. I think the parties agree that it had not been signed by the parent. So why doesn't this case require a reversal for failure to comply with the statutory requirements?
I think that certainly if this were a case like the case cited by counsel ARB, that might be appropriate. If there were a willful failure on the part of the county to disregard the case plan requirements. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is that the case plan was developed. There were two social workers actually who either met with JDK or attempted to meet with JDK at the very beginning of the case back in March of 2019. The initial social worker, the investigating social worker, was Rebecca Foy. She made a couple of attempts to meet with JDK, and I believe actually did meet with him on a second occasion. Then Sarah, now Schmidt, met with him, tried to work with him to develop. He was very hostile towards her. She developed a case plan. She met with him and talked with him about it. He refused to sign it. She submitted it to the court. The court then explained it to him in court. He did not object. He was represented by an attorney. And it's not the same kind of situation that would call for a reversal on those grounds. The difference is that in ARB, That father, there was never a case plan that addressed any of his issues. He requested a case plan. He was not given one. He was incarcerated. No services were provided to him. In this case, we have a case plan. It was developed. It was offered to him. We followed it. It's a different situation. It's much more like the Supreme Court cases that I cited in my brief, JJB, RRM, and RRM, I believe, is maybe a Court of Appeals case, and JJLB. Those cases were ones where there was one failure to meet the statutory requirement. In one case, there was a failure to provide the mother with an additional copy of the case plan. But she had a case plan already for her other children. She had another child. And the case plan continued. She understood the case plan. And in one case, the case was transferred from county to county. They continued with the case plan that had been developed in the first county. This situation is much more like those, that you have a relatively minor deficiency. And in this case, that deficiency is because of the father's actions, not a deficiency based on the county's willfulness to ignore the statute. That's not what we have here.
Okay, so to that point, I'm trying to understand your argument from the practical perspective. What I don't understand is your argument from the legal perspective. Are you saying that there was error because one of the statutory requirements wasn't met and it's harmless error? What I'm just trying to clarify and trying to understand what your legal argument is then.
I believe it would be harmless error. But I also believe that there is harmless inexcusable in that it's not, I don't believe that the statute requires us to grab the father's hand and guide his signature. And that would be the only way that we could do that. And that, frankly, would be every bit as inappropriate as what Mr. Steck is alleging that we did.
So it sounds to me, are you then relying on the prefatory language in the statute when it talks about as appropriate, the plan shall be signed by the parent?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
As to that, I would like to also address Mr. Steck's argument that this is a three-legged stool. There doesn't seem to be any argument about the other two legs, and I do want to point that out. But as to reasonable efforts, this record is really grounded in reasonable efforts. There were a number of findings of fact that the trial court made about reasonable efforts, finding that all of the six statutory prongs of how you evaluate reasonable efforts were found. The court also found that those attempts were beyond perfunctory. And I would specifically refer to findings of fact numbers 82 through 99 in the court's findings of fact, and then also the conclusions of law. And specifically, dealing with the statutory basis, the court addressed those in the conclusion of law number 15. This court also looked at the statutory ground of B15, which is reasonable efforts failing to correct the conditions. And those conclusions of law are at 10, 11, and 12. It's a different perspective, but in both those conclusions of law, as well as the specific reasonable efforts requirement to reunify, there's an evaluation of whether or not those efforts are genuine, whether or not those efforts are real, whether or not they're realistic, whether or not there was true assistance provided. Here, the court not only looked at the efforts that the county provided as part of this case plan, but also looked at the efforts that were provided when the court prodded and said, hey, you know, maybe JDK doesn't qualify for a specific program, but I want you to go back and get him into that program, even if he doesn't qualify. And the social worker did that. The social worker advocated for this father to get into various programs, and then he didn't show up. It's unfortunate that he did not take advantage of the assistance that was offered to him, and that he couldn't find his way to put his children first. I see that my time is up in less than a minute. Unless you have another question, I don't have anything else.
Thank you for your argument, Ms. Tim.
Thank you.
And appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed when you're ready, Mr. Steck.
I'd like to zero in on this signature issue because I think there's really two issues here and one of them's getting lost. The first is the requirement that the plan be jointly developed. Now, there was a lot of testimony about the case plan being developed. And it appears from that testimony that the plan was developed first, after which ACSS met with with JDK to explain it to him or to direct him to comply with it. That's not joint development, that's imposition. And with regard to the signature issue, it's essentially conceded that he didn't sign it. Now, both of these, the county is arguing that, well, it's because he was obstructionist. He was refusing to cooperate with case plan development. He was refusing to sign. And I think the court's right to zero in on the question of whether as appropriate, because there's certainly going to be cases where parents don't cooperate with the development of a case plan and don't and where they refuse to sign. And I'm not suggesting that the court should somehow take somebody's hand and force them to sign. But what I am suggesting is that if we're going to excuse the county from compliance with these statutory requirements, that there needs to be a finding of fact that says that the parent refused to cooperate with case plan development, that the parent refused to sign. That's the finding that is present in the CF unpublished case that the county cites, where the court found they refused to sign, therefore the statutory requirement can't be met, and the county is therefore excused from it. That's not present here. Ms. Tim points to some indications in the record that might support such a finding, but the court never made it.
Mr. Steck, can I stop you there? Because when I look at the statute, I'm not sure that what you're asking that we require of district courts is actually consistent with the statutory language. When I look at 260C.212 subdivision 1B, it says at the very end of that paragraph before it gets into the subparts, it says, as appropriate, and it's talking about what the district court can do. It says, as appropriate, the plan shall be, : submitted to the court for approval, ordered by the court, signed by the parent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to give the district court discretion as to whether or not those need to be met. For example, the signature. And that seems to make sense, because if you had a recalcitrant parent who simply refused to sign and then later on said, well, the district court never I never signed it, so therefore on appeal, I am entitled to reversal. That seems to be an absurd result.
Yes, Your Honor, that's not at all what I'm suggesting. I'm saying that if the court wants to view that as a situation, which I think is right, that as appropriate is saying the district court has avenues to excuse the county from these requirements. But that exercise of those avenues must be explicit. The district court must say in its order, I am finding as a matter of fact that this parent refused to cooperate in the joint development of the case plan.
So let me ask you a question in a different way. What statutory or case law support do you have for that proposition that the district court has to put that in writing as to whether in its discretion it's appropriate to require a signature or to not require a signature, for example?
I would look to both the ARB and the CF cases. The ARB case says explicitly that this signature requirement is not subject to harmless error analysis. And then CF, in distinguishing itself from ARB, says in this case, the court made a finding that the parent had refused to sign and that the parent was not cooperative in developing the case plan. So what CF and ARB taken together say is that yes, the county can be relieved of these statutory requirements and that these aren't fatal errors, but only if there is an explicit finding of fact by the court to support that, and then an exercise of its discretion to say the county is no longer required to comply with these statutory requirements. Absent that finding, the county is required to comply with those statutory requirements, and therefore reversal is required in this case.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case is now submitted and we will be issuing our opinion within the next 90 days.